You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We'll send a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America, the best idea since democracy.
Hello and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, and boys and girls, and children of all ages, to the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, brought to you every week at Wednesday, 3 p.m. Central, right here on RadioAryan.com. As always, I am your host, Billy Roper, with news and political commentary from just to the right of Julius Stryker. Every week, this week is our special post-Valentine's Day edition of the Roper Report. Our post-Valentine's Day broadcast entitled A Divorce Proposal. Now, you might think that perhaps the few days after Valentine's Day, when warm, fuzzy, loving, romantic feelings are wafting through the air, might not be the most appropriate time to talk about a divorce proposal. But I'm going to tell you exactly what I mean in a few minutes, as well as discuss my prognostications and predictions for this New Year's midterm elections and their effect on our entire electoral process and the future of the United States of America, most specifically leading up to the 2020 census and the ramifications from that. But first, let's talk about Valentine's Day. You know, this past weekend was Valentine's Day, and it was also leading up to the Monday, which was 2018 celebration of Martin Luther King Day. Martin Luther King Jr., his legal name, Michael King, was a proven plagiarist and womanizer and communist sympathizer led by his Jew commie puppet master, Stanley Levison. And Michael King was trained in communist agitation and activism at the Highlander Folk Academy in Tennessee, along with Rosa Parks. It was also founded by a communist. Michael Martin Luther King, about 50 years ago, was finally made good in Memphis, just a couple of blocks from where the Shield Wall Network and our allies held our successful and victorious rally for Forrest this last weekend. And it has not gotten much better there since 1968, to be honest with you. But we hope that everyone had an opportunity over this last weekend to troll the lefties and the liberals, and especially our obsolete farm machinery, on the fact that Martin Luther King was a plagiarist and a womanizer and a commie. And there's a very real reason why his wife, Coretta Scott King, requested that the FBI files on Michael King be sealed until 2027, because it would diminish the status of the beast as saint if the general public knew the character of Michael King. But of course, it really doesn't matter to the blacks themselves. I mean, these are a people, a community, who repeatedly elected a known coke user and coke dealer to be the mayor of Washington, D.C., and they don't care how corrupt or how degenerate their politicians are, as long as they are theirs. Something that the white nationalist community and the alt-right, I guess, has begun to emulate, as we're trying to, instead of out-Jew the Jew, we're trying to out-nigger the nigger. We've reached a point in the white nationalist community where many in the alt-right, many of the millennials, do not care how corrupt and degenerate in their personal lives spokespersons or leaders are, as long as they purport to be pro-white. I don't think that emulating niggers is the route that we should take. But of course, I'm a purity spiraler, so what do I know, right? But before the Martin Luther King holiday was Valentine's Day, and just kind of like January the 1st every year, New Year's Day is an opportunity for everyone, male and female, to often establish New Year's resolutions where they hope to improve themselves or to become better persons over the next year that's coming. February the 14th is often an opportunity for men to try to improve themselves romantically, to be better husbands or better boyfriends, or if they don't have a wife or a girlfriend, to try to improve themselves and to try to get one, right? So February the 14th is always an important day for those who have significant others and those who would like to. And each year, we like to discuss male-female relationships just a little bit more around Valentine's Day, because it's all about the cooing and the wooing and the coaxing and the hoaxing, right? What I'd like to talk about this year after Valentine's Day is, as the title of this podcast suggests, how to ask for a divorce. But this kind of separation is not a permanent one. This kind of separation is only the recognition that males and females are different genders, different sexes, different halves of a whole, complementary, but very different. And not just in terms of plumbing and anatomy, in terms of hardwired brain chemistry as well, in terms of the chemicals that float around in our cerebral cortexes and make us react the way that we do differently. The old saying, you know, man being from Mars and women being from Venus, we would be lucky if we were from the same solar system sometimes. And it's been said that you should never take advice about drinking from someone who had never taken a sip. You should never take advice about smoking from somebody who'd never lit up. And you should never probably take advice about male-female relationships or the differences between men and women from somebody who hasn't had a lot of experience in the field. Well, I have actually experienced 4 marriages and 3 divorces, and I'm still going strong, knock on wood, but I've very rarely, even in those times, been without female companionship for much longer than I really wanted to. And that's not because I'm handsome and not because I'm wealthy, far from it. It's just because I think that, to some degree, I understand women and I understand men. I understand myself. So I'm going to speak just a little bit about male-female differences and how that applies to the white nationalist movement. Now, ultimately, we do have to recognize that we are not the same. Equality does not exist between the races, between the subspecies of the species, and equality does not exist in terms of being interchangeable between the genders of our species. I know that there are some neo-feminists who are offended by me saying that men and women are not equal and interchangeable, but the fact is that we are not. We have our own purposes, our own raison d'etre, our reasons for being, and we have complementary roles to play in life. God made it that way. Men and women have different temperaments, different personalities, different specialties. Women were created to be a helpmate for men, and men were created to defend women. And that leads us into the point of today's discussion. How should women behave and how should men behave? In other words, if you are a man who is racially conscious and you would like to have a mate, how should you behave? Likewise, if you are a woman who is racially conscious and you would like to find a good guy, how should you behave? How should you attract the ideal mate that'll be complimentary for you if you are alone? I know a lot of people who are racially conscious have difficulty finding mates, and guys as well as girls. It's funny, on the internet, on social media, you will see, you know, white nationalist guys saying that there are no good women in the movement, and you'll see women saying that there are no good guys in the movement. But the fact is, they're both side by side making the same complaints. And we need to recognize how we should behave in order to attract that ideal mate. So this also is very apropos to a policy decision and directive which I have made over the last 24 hours in regards to the Shield Wall phalanx. We had a female member of the Shield Wall Network who wanted to ask me if she could join the phalanx, and I had to decline her request because the Shield Wall phalanx is only for men. And as the aftermath and repercussions of that developed, I had to place it into actual physical policy. Now, I believe that this directive and this policy for the Shield Wall phalanx is so natural, so organic, so wholesome and healthy and obvious that it's just common sense. And I further believe that most, if not all, other organizations throughout the hard right will soon adopt this policy that I've developed and made into a directive for the Shield Wall phalanx. Now, basically, the Shield Wall phalanx is going to train itself and its military-aged men into a defensive arm to carry out protests and rallies and demonstrations and other public events. Now, while all of our ladies and our future female members and our children involved in our family-oriented activities and our elderly are, as always, still welcome to attend Shield Wall Network meetings and campouts and socials, they will not be encouraged to attend public rallies and protests and demonstrations, which, let's face it, have all become more and more polarized and divided and potentially hostile over the last couple of years, and after Charlottesville especially. There are no public protests and rallies anymore which aren't potential combat. And I oppose, and always have opposed, women being involved in combat. That's not to say that women do not have their role in a public sphere, as organizers, as recruiters, in their natural role as comforters and as nurturers. However, I do not want our ladies to be on the front lines fighting our fights. And I think that I'm not alone in that. For example, no one can name any white nationalist or alt-right organization which holds public protests or rallies or demonstrations whose leaders' wives or girlfriends get out there on the front line with them. It simply is not done, and there's a reason why. It's because men have the responsibility and the duty in life to protect our women. So I'm going to read to you my directive, and then we'll discuss those different traditional roles and how they play into modern-day political activism. Now, obviously, this was posted on the Shield Wall Network website, which you can access by going to shieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com or by simply typing in arianwarrior.com. And the topic is Shield Wall Phalanx. The title is Women in the Shield Wall. The decision that from this point forward, public protests and rallies and demonstrations will be participated in by Shield Wall Phalanx members and probates rather than by the general Shield Wall Network membership was mine alone. No one else should be credited or blamed for it, as the case may be. It was made in consultation with others and with their input and advice, as always, but it, like the safety of our people, is my responsibility. Public events have become as hostile and potentially violent as they could possibly become, but they're still getting worse as America continues to polarize and divide and things heat up on the way to actual war and balkanization. It's really to the point that I cannot, in good conscience, continue to put our ladies and our children and our elderly at risk in them. In fact, things have developed to the point where public events are all potential combat zones, like I said, and I've always opposed women serving in combat, all the reasons why women should not serve in combat. Their different temperaments, their physical differences, the morale effect on others, including men on their side, the distraction liability, because men will go to the aid of a woman who is under attack, even if that means breaking the shield wall. They also now apply to public protest. I wish that were not the case on one hand, because honestly, I've always felt that having ladies and children and the elderly present at rallies does make good optics. However, I have never been an optics cuck, and I will not sacrifice the safety of our people or our mission on the altar of optics. Our enemies and our friends are just going to have to get used to the new optics that we'll present of fighting age men in the shield wall. And our ladies and elderly and children will just have to accept that we exist to protect them. Of course, you know, like I said, Shield Wall Network meetings and our campouts and our banquets and dinners and our social events and outings are all open to ladies and children and affiliates of any age as always. Women make the best recruiters, often the best organizers. And in fact, I hope that we can recruit more female Shield Wall members in the future and welcome them as nurturers, as teachers. However, they will not be serving in potential combat roles with the shield wall phalanx. They're not that expendable. They're more important than that. They are our wives and our girlfriends, our sisters and our mothers and our daughters. They are our life bearers, our nurturers, our healers, our teachers, and our inspiration. If we think of ancient Greek history, when Helen of Troy walked around the walls of the city to inspire the men to fight. When we think of ancient Norse American history, when the Vikings were fighting the Indians and it looked like they were about to be overwhelmed, and the Norse woman pulled down her shirt and slapped her breast with a sword to remind the men what would happen to her if they failed. Women have always inspired and encouraged men to greater valor and to combat, but they should not be there on the front lines with us. They are not cannon fodder. Us ugly guys are. So let's hold women to a higher pedestal than that. A higher, more important role than that. Our women are the reason why we fight. But they're not going to fight with us. At least not in the shield wall phalanx. We're going to fight for them. Now that will alienate some people. That will upset some people. But that's just how it's going to be. So while we welcome ladies, as well as children and elderly, to our meetings and to participate in the Shield Wall Network, the organization and the coalition, and all of our public activities, which are not protests and rallies and demonstrations, at those kind of potentially volatile and hostile, violent events, we do not encourage women and children and elderly to attend from this point forward. So we are accelerating our training sessions of the Shield Wall Phalanx to make sure that we have enough men to participate in each of these protests. Whether they are in Memphis or in Little Rock or in Harrison and Batesville or wherever they may happen to be held. And we are dividing up the Shield Wall Phalanx geographically into different regions and setting different officers of the organization in charge of those regions. So in addition to our United training sessions, the next one of which will be January the 20th, we'll be having regional training sessions with each state divided up into quarters so that no Phalanx member should have to drive more than a couple of hours in order to participate in a training session. And then we will have United Shield Wall Phalanx training sessions with the entire defensive arm together at the same time and location of each of our regular Shield Wall Network meetings, the next of which will be February the 17th. If you'd like to get involved with the Shield Wall Network Phalanx or with the Shield Wall Network itself, then I encourage you to go to the Shield Wall Network website at arianwarrior.com or to email me, roper_billy@yahoo.com. But now to how men should behave to attract women and how women should behave to attract men. Many men in the white nationalist movement get involved in this MGTOW BS, or with the white Sharia BS, because they are frustrated and disgruntled and do not have a girl. Well, that's not the way to go about it. You know, this is not caveman days where you hit a woman over the head and drag her by the hair back to your cave. And we don't want to return to those days, I would hope. I honor chivalry. I honor men defending our women. And what we want to do is to provide the kind of security and peace and safety that women desperately want. Women are nest builders. They like to have a safe family home, not threatened by the enemy. That's why they're attracted to men who are strong enough to defend them and their children and to protect the family nest. Women are not attracted to weak guys or to cowards or to gutless cucks. Men are not attracted to butch feminists. Men are not attracted to Xena warrior princess. Men are attracted to feminine, not feminist, women. And there is a stark difference. Each gender has traditional roles to play. Adherence to those traditional gender roles will make you more attractive to the opposite gender. This should not be rocket science, but apparently it has been confused through the controlled media and public education brainwashing of what our roles should be. I promise you that women are not really attracted to sensitive, empathetic guys. And ladies, I promise you that guys are really not attracted to women who want to stand shoulder to shoulder with them and duke it out with the enemies. Just doesn't work that way. That's not how we are hardwired. Women, because of their particular reproductive strategy, and this mentally continues even past the reproductive years, are attracted to men who can protect them and their offspring, because they have to invest more than 9 months. They have to invest years into each new baby. When that baby, and by extension, to a large degree themselves, are pretty much defenseless. Now, men's reproductive strategy is a lot shorter in terms of their investment, right? So the reproductive strategies of men and women evolve differently, so that basically you could say women want one man to give them everything that they need. Men want every woman to give them the one thing that they need, because it benefits men genetically in terms of passing on their genetic material to the next generation to spread that seed as wide as possible in as short amount of time as possible. And it benefits women because of their reproductive technique and strategy to pass on their genetic material to the next generation by being protected and defended for a long term and not spreading their seed as wide. And that probably has something to do, at least psychologically, with the hypocrisy we often see when it comes to, you know, guys who have a lot of partners are seen as being successful, and women who have a lot of partners are seen as being sluts. Because we recognize that evolutionarily speaking, organically and naturally, in a healthy sense, that's contradictory to a woman's healthy reproductive strategy. But it's actually right along with a man's. So, a lot of these guys who don't have girls complain that women are traitors, women are too sympathetic, women are too liberal, women empathize with non-whites or with homosexuals, they're too left-wing, they all support Hillary. Well, women do have more natural empathy for the underdog, and that comes from the natural altruism that developed over hundreds of thousands of years when it really was what kept a screaming baby from being thrown out of the cave at 3 a.m. Without it, we'd be extinct. It's only when we men allow aliens, others, foreigners, non-whites into our society that that natural and healthy altruism of women becomes a negative, because it's then applied to the underdog, to the minorities, to the non-whites. If we men did our job of protecting our societies from non-whites to begin with, they would not be in our societies for women's misplaced altruism to give sympathy to. Make sense? Likewise, if men in our natural role as leaders and shepherds actually controlled our government and our society and had control over our destiny as a people, if we had not abdicated it to foreigners and to those who support foreigners who are psychologically ill, then there would not be the opportunity for women to be brainwashed and misled and weaponized against us as they often have been. The problem is not with women. As a man, I say that the problem is more with men, because men, I believe, are supposed to be the leaders of society and of families. And if we fail in those roles and women go off the track, then that's our fault for not providing the leadership that they need and the direction that they crave. Likewise, guys, if you think that women are not behaving naturally in a racially healthy way as they should, then examine yourself and ask if you are behaving as a racially conscious and healthy man should. Because, guys, if you are stepping off the sidewalk for niggers, if you're smiling and looking down every time you see a mixed-race couple, if you're nodding friendly-like at every Mexican you see, and a woman sees that, are you acting like an alpha male that she should be attracted to? You see, healthy women are attracted to healthy men. Healthy women are attracted to alpha males. Once again, they want that guy who can defend them and protect them and their babies, instinctually. And if you act like a beta cuck, if you act like a loser, if you act like you've been conquered, then you're not going to get the women because they're not going to be attracted to you because you're a beta. Now, think about it. Who in America today acts like the conquerors and who acts like the conquered? Who is held up as the alpha male, as the winner in society? Who's held up as the male archetype? It's not us, largely because we act like losers. We act like we're guilty and ashamed and sorry for everything that ever happened. And we're afraid to even speak up for our own people. A lot of guys won't even defend a white woman physically. How can a woman respect that? What kind of woman should? Why would you want to be with a white woman who was attracted to a beta? Women are attracted to alphas. And if you want a racially healthy, psychologically healthy white woman, then you guys need to speak and act like a racially healthy, psychologically healthy white man. Now, in turn, ladies, if you are looking for a man who will be an alpha male, then don't look for the guys who are the most empathetic and sensitive and understanding. Don't look for the guys who are easiest to get along with. Don't look for the guys who are the nicest, most thoughtful. Don't look for the guys who have the most friends. Look for the guys who do not care if they piss people off. Look for the guys who actually revel in being abrasive. There's a reason why women are attracted to bad boys and rebels. It's because we don't follow the crowd. We are leaders. And if we're not able to be leaders, then we at least are independent enough to be outlaws. Ladies, if you want to attract the kind of man that you at least act like you want to have, then don't try to outman them. Be feminine. Be soft. That's what attracts men. If you want to attract a racially healthy and psychologically healthy white man, then behave like a psychologically healthy white woman. Be soft and tender and feminine, because that is what is attractive to men. I know this is something that you have been taught is weak, but it's really what men want. And you can read all the self-help books and romance novels and watch all of the movies that you want on the Hallmark Channel. The reality is, it just comes down to hard-boiled, hardwired human sexual instinct. Women, if you want to attract the kind of man that you say that you want, then be a woman. Be traditional. Be feminine. Be soft and be tender. Men, if you want to attract the kind of woman that you think that you want, that you act like you want, that you say that you want, then be hard. Be an alpha male. Be a leader. Don't step off the sidewalk for our racial enemies, because you can't expect any woman to realistically respect you if you're not a victim, if you are a loser. Now, how that relates to the movement, white nationalism, is that in the aftermath of the Memphis rally, when we decided that from now forward, in public demonstrations and protests, only the phalanx of the Shield Wall was going to participate, and that the phalanx was only going to have male members. We also had to look at the behavior of our allies and compare that to the behavior of our enemies and the behavior of our friends. Now, obviously, we could say that the conservatives, the Rainbow Confederates, were weak and pussified and gutless and cowardly because they were afraid of being called racist. And they virtue signaled against us in our role as white nationalists in Memphis because we were not afraid of being called racist. And we carried the day, had a successful, victorious protest regardless, and got more media out of it than they did, actually. But their problem was they were afraid of being called racist and white supremacist, and they still got called it anyway. But they never learn, do they? They never learn. Now, in contrast, we had a lot of white nationalists and alt-right who had pledged to be there with us side by side and then deserted us, some of them a couple days before and some of them the day before and some of them a few hours before, frankly. But be that as it may, who's actually more cowardly? The person who does not consider themselves to be a racist and virtue signals against the term, or the person who accepts the term of being a racist and a white nationalist, but then is afraid of a bunch of street niggers? And in this case, really just a handful of street niggers and a handful of Antifa that don't have a watch among them. They're always late. I mean, if white nationalists and the alt-right, who are supposed to be these warriors, especially the cream of the crop, who want to go to demonstrations and protest and hold their shields and their helmets and fight against the enemy, are afraid to go to Memphis because they might have to actually fight with some niggers, what do they think is going to happen in our future? Do they think that we're going to take our country back? We're going to march in and say, okay, America is the white man's land again, and that all these niggers are just going to say, yassa massa, and step out of our way without a fight? Do they think that as we literally battle in the coming civil war for the survival of our race, that there's not going to be some bloodshed? Do they think that there might not be times when we are outnumbered? Do you think that there will never be a time when we are in enemy, hostile territory? Is that what they expect? If so, then they need to quit the white nationalist movement and go join a bowling team, right? Because it's not going to be that way. It's not going to be like a movie or comic book, or it's not going to be like a first-person shooter, to reference an analogy that they'd probably be more comfortable with. It's going to be very real. It's going to be scary at times. It's going to be bloody. And some people are probably going to get hurt. Guaranteed. So, who's more gutless? The Rainbow Confederates, who were afraid of being called racist but still at least came to Memphis? Or the white nationalists and alt-right, who didn't have enough testicles between all of them to even show up because they might have to fight some niggers, and they might be outnumbered. Lord help us. You know, traditional values for both male and female dictate that things are going to get more real from here on out. And we're going to have to respond in traditional ways to them in order to survive and conquer. We cannot have women on the front lines with us in the Shield Wall, trading punches with the enemy, distracting us whenever they need help, because our natural instincts, just as when we discussed having women in combat in the armed forces, are going to be to protect them. And we cannot have men calling themselves white nationalist men who are afraid of being outnumbered or who are afraid of potentially fighting the enemy. We're not going to take care of this problem peacefully or at the ballot box. Every single time is not going to be safe. And if safety and peace is what you're looking for, then you're in the wrong game. This is real. It's going to get more real. Folks, I can tell you that if you are uncomfortable with walking with Billy Roper into Memphis because you would have been outnumbered and it potentially might have gotten violent, then you really do not need to be in the white nationalist movement, because I warn you, from here on out, it's not going to get any safer or more peaceful. However, if you're willing to buck up, grab a hold of your nuts, and be a man, then the Shieldwall Phalanx is where you need to be, obviously, because we proved that last weekend in Memphis. So when we think about women's role traditionally, I'm not saying that all women should be barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. I'm not saying that women should only cook and crochet and raise kids. I'm saying that women are so precious that they cannot and should not be expendable and thrown onto the front lines for our enemies to have access to. Now, if there were opportunities for large public protest and women could have a role serving as medics or as auxiliaries or as accessory helpers, then that might be hypothetically possible, but that would then require, because we did actually discuss this, that would then require having a safe area, a defended, protected area for the women to do that in. And often, our public protest and demonstrations and rallies are going to be in hostile areas. We will not have the manpower to set aside a defended area for women to be there for triage or for medic service. And we're also not going to be able to defend that area in terms of numbers or geography or topography or having control of the city and the situation. So we have to start thinking less like a junior high school glee club and more like an actual military. And like an actual military, we're going to have to more and more leave our women and our children behind at home and go out to face the enemy to protect them, to defend them, not to drag them along with us and treat us as if we're all interchangeable. We are not. Women are more important than that. And so I'm not a feminist. I believe in trad values, and trad values mean that women should not be on the front line with men. I hope that's not too offensive to too many people, but it is now the official policy of the Shieldwall Network and our defensive arm, the Shieldwall Phalanx. Now, I'd like to take just a minute to talk about the 2018 midterm elections and what they will actually mean for our people's future. As we look at Donald Trump now being willing to accept the DACA, which is Deferred Action for Criminal Illegal Aliens, and the Dreamers, giving them citizenship, and then through chain migration, allowing their family to stay, rather than keeping families together, which is the humane thing, by deporting all of them back to Mexico or wherever they came from, whatever, as he said, shithole country they crawled out of, then we're looking at not having a wall, not having border security, but having millions of more illegal aliens turned into voters, and they're going to vote Democratic. They're going to vote blue. They're going to vote for large government and anti-white policies, as they already do, without doubt. And that means that these red states that are kind of on the hinge of being purple are going to turn blue. So Florida and Texas are going to become blue states, just like Virginia recently did. And then, electorally, in terms of the Electoral College, it will be impossible for probably any white guy, but definitely any conservative at all, to ever be elected president again. Because in 2020, after these midterm elections, which are probably going to give the Democrats a few more seats, when the new census is taken in 2020, and it's found that through DACA legalization and another round of amnesty, Florida and Texas and two or three other states are now majority Hispanic or plurally Hispanic, then they're going to be blue states. And by that next election, the Democrats are going to have control of the Electoral College. That's the demographic destiny and future of our nation, which is why balkanization, polarization, and division is our best bet. Because civic nationalism has failed us, and we're not going to vote our way back into power or get the whole enchilada, no pun intended, back again. DACA amnesty, Dreamer amnesty, and the future immigration reform, which will lead to legalization of the tens of millions of illegal immigrants already here, and making them into citizens and voters, will mean that whites will have forever lost the opportunity through the electoral process and the ballot box to gain any power again. So we can only hope for breakup. Now, on the Roper Report website, which you can get to by going to the Roper Report site.wordpress.com or through whitenationalists.com, there's a new article up that's actually from a left-wing point of view, a liberal perspective, called Divisible, Breaking Up the U.S. And it talks about how anti-white communists, speaking of divorce, now want division just as much as we do. Now, this is how it comes full circle, asking for a divorce, not just in separating the roles of men and women in public protests and rallies and demonstrations, not just in separating the belief that we are, as different genders, interchangeable, but also in terms of separation and divorce, dividing up the country. Now, here's what they're saying about it. In the article entitled Divisible, Breaking Up the U.S. by a leftist called Broma, which came from a leftist site, which you can actually get a hyperlink to from the Rope Report website. It says, what will the dismemberment of the U.S. look like? There are lots of theoretical possibilities with different timelines, but more than likely, a breakup will happen along the deep national fault lines that already exist. And this is just a brief quote from that article. Unfortunately, on a practical level, the radical right is ahead of us here. Many diehard fundamentalists and neo-fascists have already started building enclaves of their own. Yes, we have. They've grasped a harsh reality that in a chaotic, deteriorating, violent society, a group's chances of survival increase according to their social unity, self-sufficiency, control of territory, and capability for self-defense. With or without our intervention, the U.S. will disintegrate eventually. If it happens without us planning it or even expecting it, we could be disoriented and caught in the crossfire. It's far better to be prepared and proactive. In coming years, as the empire weakens, many strategies for revolutionary change will be proposed, discussed, and attempted. The breakup of the U.S. must be central to those strategies. So here we have left-wing anti-white commies talking about the balkanization and breakup of America as being a good thing, a necessary thing, because obviously, like I told the reporters in Memphis, if you believe the United States is based on racist and systematic supremacy, institutional racism and bigotry, then the only solution is to separate yourself from that racist enterprise, from the entire unconscious white privilege and bigotry of whites completely, and to allow yourself to have self-determination as a people, to have your own government where you can promote your own culture and your own heritage and your own people's best interest without having evil, racist, oppressive whites. And leftists are glomming onto that. That's why they now have declared California to be a sanctuary state, and you have leftists pushing for states' rights for everything from marijuana legalization to not supporting federal immigration laws and the actual secession movement in California and other liberal enclaves on both coasts is a left-wing phenomenon. So we have a situation where both parties in the marriage want separation, want divorce, and the marriage counselor on always shrinking central foundations in the middle, as the center cannot hold, is begging them to stay together. But divorce is inevitable. The leftists are recognizing it, and more our people are too. So to sum up, the Shield Wall Phalanx will no longer be having women in our ranks at public protests, demonstrations, and rallies, nor will we be having children or the elderly in harm's way as those public events become more and more potentially hostile and violent. However, we encourage women to become part of the Shield Wall Network so that they can fulfill their traditional and healthy roles alongside men, but not in the Shield Wall. And we also want to look forward to the 2018 midterm elections and watch as gridlock increases. The Republicans will lose some seats, the Democrats will gain a few. And ultimately, we're looking forward to the DACA dreamers getting amnesty and more amnesty and no wall being built in exchange for it, as some of the 11 to 20 million other illegal immigrants that have gotten here through chain migration are given citizenship and the right to vote as well, which means by 2020, America will face a blue state deluge, which will make the electoral opportunity for whites null and void, and will make balkanization more and more necessary, and inevitable. Divorce of men and women from the egalitarian idea that we are interchangeable to a more traditional, separate roles within the shield wall network and the phalanx. Divorce of our nation, red from blue, white from non-white. And of course, as always, unity of our people. So, until next time, this is Billy Roper for the Shield Wall Network and the Roper Report on RadioArian.com, reminding you to think racially, act locally, but no matter what, keep it white.
Deutschland! Sieg Heil! Deutschland! Sieg Heil! Deutschland! Sieg Heil! Deutschland! Sieg Heil! Deutschland! Sieg Heil!
You know, guys, one of my most fond and most often recalled memories of Dr. William Pierce, who I worked for and with for the last 2.5 years of his life as his membership director of the National Alliance in West Virginia, was when he would actually record the American Dissident Voices broadcast each week, and then actually would record the audio books where he himself would read the Turner Diaries. And eventually, of course, those were turned into CD audiobooks, which are now available. My office was on the second floor of the National Alliance office building, the original one, and right next to it, actually, you had to walk through the studio to get to my office, was the recording studio. And so each week, when it came time for Dr. Pierce to record the American Dissident Voices podcast, or whenever he actually would get the opportunity to put some time in recording on his audiobook, he would knock on my door and open it and come in and ask me to turn the phone off and to turn the computer audio down and to be as quiet as possible so that he could record. So I would, of course, unplug the phone, turn the audio down, make everything as quiet as possible so there would be no interruptions from my part, bleeding over through the office door into the recording studio where he was going to be recording, and I would sit and listen in fascination as Dr. William Pierce would speak each week and also as he would read his own words into the audiobook of the Turner Diaries. And sometimes some of the more humorous memories I have were the outtakes and the bloopers when he would mess up and he would sometimes have a stream of curses and stomp around. But it was very humorous, you know, and I have to try to be quiet and not laugh. But he did, obviously, so much for our people. Such a brilliant man. To have the opportunity to experience that, which most people never saw or heard, was a great honor for me, obviously. And it kind of reminded me of how important audiobooks are. You know, we live in an age when many people just don't have time or the energy or inclination to read anymore, unless they're reading short articles or memes on the internet. Very few people, even our own people, read books. And I say that as an author. I've written 14 published books, fiction and nonfiction. And I actually am, I think, without any hyperbole, the most read living white nationalist author today, especially my Haste in the Day trilogy. But my fiction and my nonfiction both. In terms of nonfiction, probably the bulk. But a lot of people have never read any of my books. I understand that. And it's because a lot of people do not read many books. And if they do, they're going to read the classics, which everyone else has read. So it's hard for an established author to have people exposed to their literary works and their ideas, because all of my books, fiction and nonfiction, all 14 of them, actually forward the message of white racial survival through one context or another, even my science fiction books. But a lot of people, as I said, have not read them, and I noticed that a lot of people listen to audiobooks. And as I began discussing this new idea, I did some research, I did some beta testing, and a lot of people told me their technological level is advanced to the point that they actually can download YouTube videos, the audio of them, or even CDs onto MP3 players and use the MP3 players to listen to or actually to input that data from the MP3 players into their car stereo system. And so some people can listen directly to audiobooks through CD form and some through MP3 form, which they can get off of a CD to make it more portable for them, more accessible. And that's great. I love the fact that we are, as the white nationalist movement, able to adapt to improving and changing technology. And I don't want to be behind the curve on that. And more importantly, don't want what I've written, fiction and nonfiction, in terms of published books, to be inaccessible to people who don't have the time or really, to be frank, the inclination to read print books any longer. Or at least not as they're being churned out. So, I am forwarding the idea, after it's been recommended and suggested to me, of producing my books as audiobooks. And I am now testing the waters to see what kind of interest there might be for Billy Roper's audiobooks. Most people who responded initially have said that they think that I should begin with Hasten the Day, which is now available in a lot of public library systems and can be gotten through interlibrary loan. And is still, even though it was my first published book, my bestseller. It's a book about the first year of the Balkanization of America as the United States breaks up into rising ethnostates and how that might be triggered and how it would develop. So I'm going to read for just a couple of minutes to give you an idea. Of course, I anticipate that as I move forward in the recording process, my reading voice and my speech would become more expressive and clearer and more practiced. But without that practice, it would go something like this. From chapter 1, page 1 of Hasten the Day. 8 miles high and falling fast. Tell the little thug that I'm not Dr. Doolittle, Captain John W. McNabb stuttered through chattering teeth. His young Corporal Kipp's face tightened, then eased in understanding a moment later. Right. You don't talk to animals, sir? You got it in one, Kip. He turned back towards the wood-burning stove, warming this end of the officer's tent, wondering how bad off the 11,000 youths nominally led by the Chicago New Black Panther Party must be without heat, power, and much food, not to mention door plumbing, now that winter was closing in. Food must be scarcer than hen's teeth, as his downstate Corn Belt mama had always said. For quasi-myth what's-his-lips, the third to send a scared gangbanger across the 2-mile no-man's land of impromptu funeral pyres and scrap metal piles to the Indiana National Guard picket line. But what was there left to talk about? McNabb's Hoosiers, all 350 of them, combat-hardened in the fires of Peoria, just had to continue to hold Gary and this northeast end of the circle, slowly choking down the Windy City until the colonel said to let up. Nothing but a thing to John. Going on snipe hunts for youths was what he did. He was a glorified cop, a peacekeeper, a stabilizer, and a first responder with air support. Well, sometimes. The grimy desk calendar held down flat on the split webbing of a lawn chair by his helmet told him that they had been here for nearly 2 months now. Every time he staggered onto his cot to snatch an hour or two of regulation coma, he saw the pages staring at him accusingly. October winds blew chill off Lake Michigan, and the first snowfall could come at any time. So the sleeping bag covers were cool and damp beneath him, inviting. John said a quick but sincere prayer over his simple evening meal. He poked at the mystery meat on his tray with a fork and tried to recapture the last 5 months of downward spiraling since Cinco Day. America had come under attack by minority insurgents. The non-white revolutionaries had nearly destroyed his nation. Only men like him now stood in their way. He added a prayer, postscript, for America. Things had already been bad before last Christmas. The country had been more polarized and divided than since the last Civil War. Another round of corporate and big bank defaults, bailouts, failures, and closings. The U.S. budget deficit topping $20 trillion with no end in sight. Congress refusing to act to limit the growth of government spending. They were afraid of upsetting the entitlement minority majority in their constituencies before the next election. The president was seen as weak and vacillating abroad and abrasive at home. She had lost everyone's respect. Partisan politics had become so divisive that no middle ground was reachable. There was no more moderate middle, no more room for compromise. The Islamic State gained ground in the Middle East, mocking America as being cowardly and impotent. another round of amnesty for illegal immigrants under the guise of immigration reform by executive order. Red state versus blue state. International banks, then foreign monetary exchanges, devalued the dollar 3 times in less than a month. The Federal Reserve responded by dropping interest rates to zero, but they couldn't pay people to take dollars. The real crippling agent was hyperinflation. John remembered the surprising sense of fear as people scrambled to buy anything tangible, physical, of value. In descending order, all of the gas and guns and ammo and grocery store shelves were bought and sold. Either in a matter of days or hours, there was little left to buy, depending on where you were. Still, inflation soared. Many people took the chance to pay off their mortgages and their car loans and their credit cards, but none of that really mattered anymore. The dollar became worthless. By February, the hyperinflation had ended most consumer production and bitten deeply into slumping retail sales. The national unemployment rate reached 15%. The Fed printed paper like it was free. Next, the stock market slipped and cotton then slipped again. Heating oil prices doubled in the Northeast. As spring came, it seemed there might be some respite. Then, somebody decided to kick us while we were down, McNabb thought bitterly. First Mexicans and other Latinos and then blacks attacked the U.S. It had been a real stab in the back. The next illegal immigration amnesty plan was being opposed so staunchly by most white Americans that the Secure Our Border demonstrations made national headlines and led the TV news top stories throughout the month of April. Clashes with immigrant counter-protesters spread. Much of the opposition to more immigration was due to the nation having the highest rate of unemployment since the Great Depression. Admittedly, some of the resentment was due to racial tension as well. The Mexican media and government responded by calling the demonstrations racist and antagonistic. They called on Mexicans on both sides of the border to resist and fight back against Yankee racism. The rhetoric escalated quickly into violence. A group of elderly Tea Party activists protesting illegal immigration were savagely beaten by a group of Hispanic activists. Emboldened by that success, another group of Hispanics tried the same trick on a different anti-immigration group, but came away bloodied. One of the protesters was carrying a concealed handgun. 8 of the Latino gang members got to stay in America the hard way. Some law enforcement agencies had abdicated their duties and responsibilities to the people, just as King George had done before 1776, in the captain's opinion. The people then had to do their jobs for them. On May the 5th, organized and well-planned chain-fire counter-protesters had ripped across the cities from the southwest to the northeast. Rioting led to looting and, worst of all, to police departments being overwhelmed and, in a couple of cases, simply outgunned. In several urban areas and border states, National Guard units were called up and just as quickly locked down because some units started shooting the protesters, or joining them, then shooting each other. The mass organized rapes of white women and girls by Hispanic gangs began as a terror tactic to drive whites out. The growth of white militias exploded in response. Unlike the anti-government fantasies of some ironically self-labeled patriot groups, the reality of the situation was that most armed whites became de facto white nationalists, and most white nationalists became counterinsurgents, counter-revolutionaries, fighting against the rebels. In most cases, they found themselves fighting against those who were intent on destroying America by fighting to defend whatever vestiges of law and order remained. It was the compassion and love of brave white men and women for their people that drove them to defend their nation. If you'd like to read more of Hasten the Day by Billy Roper, I encourage you to go to Amazon.com and enter the title of the book, Hasten the Day by Billy Roper. And also, if you're interested in the future audiobook of Hasten the Day, which I will create again after a bit more of practice and polish, then I encourage you to stay tuned to the Roper Report website and to the Roper Report podcast here on RadioArian.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
The student band, I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right. Do the fire outside to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're at a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, because they are to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America, the best idea since democracy.
an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArian.com.